From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, a new study sheds light on the public's perceptions on participating in medical trials. And a book explores informed consent in medicine and the vast gray area when it comes to scientists using a patient's blood samples in research.
There's no requirement, anonymous or not, about telling people their tissues may become profitable and that someone may, you know, make products using them or develop, you know, things that would become patented that would become valuable.
We'll discuss how removing residency requirements for public workers could affect the Milwaukee real estate market. And Joe Bartolotta shares one of the reasons his restaurant business has been a success for 20 years.
Part of my responsibility is to not only enhance my life and my family's life, but to enhance the people around us and bring everybody's standard of living up a little bit.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. Many, if not all, of the features we do on medical research are dependent on clinical trials. Testing the effectiveness of therapies is the way new drugs go to market and how new treatments are approved for patients. But there are increasing concerns among researchers and patient advocates that the number of people enrolling in clinical trials in this country is not as high as it needs to be. The question is why, and it turns out that not a great deal of research has been done into public attitudes towards clinical trials. Researcher Catherine Flynn set out to change that. Flynn is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and an investigator at MCW's Center for Patient Care and Outcomes Research. She talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about her study, which appears in the latest edition of the journal Clinical Trials.
Clinical trials are an extremely important part of clinical research. They provide critical evidence about which strategies and therapies are most effective to diagnose and treat patients.
Well, and so at the beginning of the day, is there an issue right now in medicine that there are not enough people enrolling in clinical trials?
Yeah, actually, enrollment is one of the issues that we face. You know, it can be difficult to get enough patients into a trial. And when we don't get enough patients into a trial, then a lot of money is wasted trying to get that trial set up. And then we don't find out the answer that we need because we don't have enough patients.
So are there trials that never get off the ground just because they don't enroll enough people?
Yes, I would say there are trials that we don't end up finding the answer to, the question that we were asking and trying to answer with that trial.
So what do we know about the challenges in finding the right people to enroll?
Some of the challenges relate to having a diversity of patients. So, for example, a lot of clinical trials are moving outside the U.S. for various reasons. And that's a problem because, you know, the drugs or devices or other products that we're trying to test and make sure that they're safe, we want to make sure that those things work in a U.S. population. And so we need to have clinical research being done in the U.S. in order to be sure that these things will work for Americans.
So there is something distinct about a U.S. population. You know, while people are all people, there is something distinct about the people in the United States that makes it important to do this work here?
Absolutely. And what's especially important about that question is that we don't always know what those things are that make people in different places different or similar to each other. So there are some obvious things that you might think of. And if we know that there's something that makes someone different, we can do what we call control for that in a statistical model. But there are all sorts of things that we don't know. And so we want to.
But it's important to be able to – essentially, it's important to be able to figure out, you know, before you can control for something, you have to find out what the data is to begin with.
Absolutely.
And there have obviously been some well-publicized issues in the past surrounding medical research undertaken without consent.
Absolutely. There is an unfortunate legacy of people not being told what the research – well, not being told that they were participating in research. And yes, that is a problem in the history of research, and it's a reason some people feel uncomfortable participating in research. However, now there are lots of safeguards in place, and when those things are followed, which we hope that they are, and I think they typically are, they do protect humans who are participating in research.
Well, and so if there are already issues surrounding getting people enrolled in clinical trials, how did you reach out and find people to even ask their attitudes towards clinical trials?
So in a way, this was easier because, you know, we can advertise a study and it doesn't require you to have a certain condition and it doesn't require you to, say, take a drug that you don't know what might happen to you. All it required you to do was to come to a meeting place and meet with about 6 to 10 other people and talk for an hour. So we didn't have any problems enrolling for this particular study.
In a sense, this was a clinical trial about clinical trials.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so what were the sorts of questions you asked them?
So these were focus groups that we conducted with community participants. Some of them were people who had already participated in clinical trials, and some of them, about half of them, were people who hadn't previously participated in a trial. And so we held these groups, and we started with defining some common terms. So we were going to be talking about clinical trials, and we needed to make sure that everyone was sort of on the same page with what these different terms meant. And so we had a little, basically a brief educational session where we asked people what different terms meant. What is clinical research? What are clinical trials? And talked about the answer and made sure everyone understood. And then we gave some additional information about what happens during the course of a trial where we're gathering information from people and we're starting to have a better idea of the safety of the product. You know, as people participate in trials, they're also sort of living their lives and things can happen to them. They could experience what's called an adverse event. Where it's just some side effect or something that happens and they can report that. The problem during the course of the trial is that we don't necessarily know whether that thing that happened to them is related to the drug or not because in a well-designed trial, there is what's called blinding where you don't know whether you're receiving a placebo or the drug. And so, you know, your doctor also doesn't know. And so if you have a headache or you have a heart attack, it's not obvious whether that's because you have, you know, you're predisposed to have a heart attack or because it was a side effect of the drug. And so there is a lot of regulation in place for what happens when those things occur.
Well, and so what was the message that you heard from these people?
So it was interesting. We heard, first of all, people had a pretty good understanding of the basics of clinical research, even people who had never participated in it before. But they really didn't understand these safeguards that are in place. And so when we talked about things like an institutional review board or an ethics committee, we talked about the federal government things that are in place to protect people. And when we talked about these things, people were comforted, actually. They were glad to know that these things were there and that there were people, you know, looking into the conduct of trials and making sure that people were protected.
Well, and obviously it's difficult to extrapolate these results and say it applies to everybody across all populations and all demographic groups. But was there a breakdown in attitudes based on demographic factors? I mean, were some people more likely to enroll or participate in clinical trials, or did you ask things in that way?
So this was exploratory research, and we conducted four groups. And we had separated those groups based on whether or not people had previous experience in a clinical trial. And we also separated the groups based on race. We ended up with two groups with white participants and two groups with African-American participants. And we did it that way because of this legacy that we mentioned of
Tuskegee.
Exactly. Research in the U.S. without people's consent. And there is often African-Americans will have less trust in the healthcare system and especially in research. And so we wanted people to really feel comfortable in these groups talking about, you know, any concerns they might have. However, because we only did one group of each type, we really are limited in what we're able to say that there were differences or not. I will say that, you know, in general, the themes that came out of each of these groups were the same, whether people had been in trials or not and whether they were African-American or white. So there wasn't really any sort of differences that we feel comfortable being able to say there were.
So what are the implications then for these results? So, you know, are there imperatives for medical researchers and institutions going forward?
Absolutely. You know, there is, of course, a lot of clinical research done and not necessarily a lot of research into what people understand and what they expect. And, you know, we undertook this research because of a patient advocate who is part of this group that was conducting this research, who said, you know, we're trying to improve the quality and efficiency of trials. We're trying to improve how safety is reported. But, what do patients think? What do people who are actually going to participate in these trials think? And we said, well, that's a really good question. Let's go ask them. And, you know, I think having patient advocates involved in the design of trials is really important because they bring a different perspective that isn't always well represented with the other scientists and statisticians and people who are involved in making trials. I would say that the one of the other important things that we found is when we asked people about different details related to safety reporting, and we looked at the informed consent documents that people sign in order to participate in a trial, it seems that there are some places in the consent document that are perhaps vague, and that patients themselves might interpret differently than the researchers who have written these documents. So, for example, saying that something related to safety will be reported as quickly as possible, that means something different to a researcher compared to a patient who might have experienced an adverse event.
In the age of genome sequencing, is this an especially pivotal time for this area? I wonder if, you know, the pace of medical research is accelerating, or maybe I'm attaching too much significance to where we are right now. But I mean, I wonder if, you know, we're at a point where there are more clinical trials than ever.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I think people recognize the value of clinical trials for answering important questions, and the trials are getting bigger and bigger. And this is something that the way that we conduct trials needs to change to reflect that. So, you know, when the regulations were put into place for how to conduct trials and how to monitor safety over the course of the trial, there were many more single site studies where, you know, you're conducting a study at one place. And the reality of modern clinical research is that these studies are being conducted at multiple sites all over the world. You can have mega trials with as many as 1,000 sites all over the world. And so obviously the way that we communicate with each other and regulate these trials to make sure that people are being treated the same in each of those different sites, it's essential that the entire enterprise moves along with the times.
How does this work fit in with your own area of expertise?
So my main research interests are related to patient quality of life, so how we measure quality of life in a trial, how we analyze that. I'm also interested in patient decision making. And so this sort of fits into that and thinking about, you know, patients' involvement and understanding of research.
There's a little psychology in this?
A little bit, yes, although I don't have any training in psychology. My background is in sociology and health services research, which is the study of the healthcare system.
But obviously, when you talk about decision making, this falls really closely into line with that particular area.
Absolutely.
Catherine Flynn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Catherine Flynn is an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and an investigator in MCW's Center for Patient Care and Outcomes Research. She spoke with Mitch Teich. There is a link to her study from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, how one woman's cells changed the course of medicine, but the way it was accomplished may be one reason people are suspicious of clinical trials. We'll talk with the award-winning author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks when Late Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about a study into patient attitudes towards clinical trials. Some of the public's reluctance to participate in these necessary trials could be traced to earlier studies that were done without consent. One of the most notorious breaches of medical ethics was uncovered in 1972 when it was learned that the U.S. Public Health Service let nearly 400 poor black men go untreated for syphilis in order to learn what happens to a person suffering from the disease. But the so-called Tuskegee experiment was only one example of a medical system that for a long time was racially biased and had few codified codes of ethics or consent laws. But not all of the examples were as overtly damaging as Tuskegee. One fairly simple collection of a tissue sample more than a half century ago had an enormous effect on medicine. Henrietta Lacks was a black woman living in Baltimore in 1951. She was dying of cervical cancer when doctors took a sample from the affected area, which changed the course of medical research. But members of her family never knew of the effect that Lacks' cells had, or that the cells continued to live on in perpetuity until years later. And that discovery had a profound impact on the family's life as well. The story of Lacks' cells and her family are the subject of Rebecca Skloot's award-winning book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Lake Effect's Mitch Teich reached her by phone in Chicago in 2011, and she offered a brief primer then about why Henrietta Lacks' cells differed from all the other tissue samples scientists had collected before.
Well, the big difference is that they survived and all the other ones died. So scientists had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. And no one knows exactly why that is. The difference between Henrietta's cells and all the others is still a little bit of a mystery, but her cells just never died. So they have been growing and dividing, doubling their numbers every 24 hours since 1951. And we know that she had syphilis, which can make cancer cells grow more rapidly, and she had HPV, which caused her cancer. So there's something about those viruses and her tissues that interacted together to make them grow the way they did.
It was really either the perfect storm or incredible serendipity that they happened to collect her cells and just from the right person and the right person that was doing the looking.
No, absolutely. It was a sort of perfect storm, you know, between the fact that of her cells being as powerful as they were, that she ended up at Hopkins, where the one scientist, George Guy, who was really the pioneer in all this stuff, had developed techniques that would make it possible to grow them. So it was the two of them coming together in that moment was pretty miraculous.
Well, I was hoping we could flash back to pretty early in the reporting process for you. The Lacks family was pretty reluctant to cooperate with you on telling the story. Why was it so compelling for you that you kept at it and jumped through the repeated hoops that were put in your path?
Well, you know, when I first learned about the cells, I was 16 in a basic biology class, and all I knew was that there were these incredible cells that had was really one of the most important things that happened to medicine. They came from a woman no one knew anything about, and she was black. Like, those are the only facts that I knew, and I just felt like I have to find out who she was and what her story was. I had no idea that her family had a story related to the cells. When I first started the book, I thought I was writing a book about the woman that the cells came from and the cells themselves. And my first contact with her daughter, it became very clear to me that something had happened to the family. So her children were actually used in research themselves in the 70s. No one told them that the cells were alive. She had five kids. No one told them until about 25 years after her death, when scientists came back to her kids and used them in research without their consent in order to learn more about the cells. And what followed was just literally decades of trauma for the family related to the cells. And my first phone call with her daughter, she didn't tell me what had happened, but she was so terrified to talk to me. And she kept saying, you know, she was excited about the idea of someone writing a book because then she could finally learn what these cells were and what they did for science, but that she didn't know who she could trust and maybe someone had sent me to take their cells. And none of it really made any sense to me. I didn't understand what she was talking about, but it was so clear that something had happened and that I needed to get to the bottom of why she was so reluctant to talk to me and that I would then understand the whole story. And that took about a year and a half to convince them to trust me and to talk to me.
And as became evident as you read this book, even once you earned their trust, it wasn't a consistent thing.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, and I sort of understood that where they were coming from with that. You know, when I first called, I had no idea where I fit into the larger picture of their story. And really, I was just one in a long line of people, particularly white people, who'd come along wanting something from them having to do with these cells. And it had never worked out for them. And they had never personally benefited. You know, they had a lot of, no one had ever just sat down and explained to them even what a cell was. So they didn't have a lot of understanding of the science. And, you know, an enormous industry had grown out of these cells. People, you know, it was a multi-billion dollar industry. Her kids still, you know, can't even afford health insurance. So there was a lot of anger, a lot of, you know, discrepancies in what they, just the facts of the story for them, but also in what they felt like they deserved and what they'd gotten. So, you know, and in the past they had trusted people who turned out to be there to really take advantage of them. And so, it, you know, for them, the story of their struggle to trust me is sort of part of the story of what happened to them because of these cells.
Well, one could not read that story without thinking of the term PTSD as we were reading
absolutely.
It.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting threads, obviously, that winds through the book is the evolution of informed consent laws. And I guess it would surprise people that they didn't really exist to any significant degree when Henrietta Lacks was a cancer patient in the early 50s. But it would probably surprise people even more that if she were a patient today, it's unclear what kind of consent they would need to take those cells today.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In the 50s, we didn't even have the term informed consent when Henrietta went to the hospital. So, yeah, taking her cells was standard practice, and they wouldn't have thought otherwise. Now, you know, obviously we have a lot of informed consent laws, but it's very it's very inconsistent how they apply to tissues. So if your identity is attached to your cells, that requires consent to take those and research on them, if they were taken specifically for research. But, you know, you go to the hospital, you get a biopsy, a blood sample that's for some other purpose, like a diagnostic test, and then those samples, as long as your name is removed, those are often stored and used in research, and people don't know. So there is no requirement for consent as long as it's anonymous tissue. And there's no requirement, anonymous or not, about telling people their tissues may become profitable and that someone may, you know, make products using them or develop, you know, things that would become patented that would become valuable.
Well, and we should note one significant change has happened. The cells that came from Henrietta Lacks were essentially named for her, HeLa cells, and science does not do that anymore.
Right, exactly. So they anonymize, is what they call it, all tissues that they use. Even, you know, but some of them do have your identity attached within the records because your personal medical history is part of what's interesting to them about the cells. But for them to use that does require consent and a lot of really strict regulation about protecting privacy. But it's the other cells, the millions and millions of samples that are just sort of out there in biobanks. Those are completely anonymous. But, you know, your DNA is inside of them. And we already know that it's possible to find people from anonymous DNA samples. It's been done. It's not something that's done regularly. It's not something that's easy. But there's part of the story of the HeLa cells is in some senses about how science can change and how hard it is to predict what's going to be possible. You know, when they took Henrietta's cells, they didn't know what DNA was. So they didn't know they'd someday be able to look in her cells and learn about her family. They didn't know they'd someday be worth money. So we know now that it's possible to find people using anonymous samples. So what's going to be possible with those supposedly anonymous samples in 50 years? Who knows? So there's a lot of debate about whether anonymizing something even exists anymore.
Do you think, is there something about this controversy that speaks to the kind of long simmering tension between science or scientists and non-scientists of even all races? I mean, at its heart, does science need to do a better job of justifying itself?
Yes, in some ways it is part of this much larger issue. And I think it's less about justifying itself and more about explaining itself. I think the story is so much about the importance of scientists being able to communicate science to the general public and about the general public being open to learning about science. So there's so much of the fear and controversy that surrounds science is more about not understanding than it is about not approving. And scientists aren't generally very good at explaining science to the public, and the public's not very good generally about sort of learning about it. So it's in some ways about the need for that to bridge that gap more, which a lot of scientists are working very hard to do. It's also about, you know, I think the big area of mistrust that exists has to do with commercialization of science. And, you know, people are they want to know what's going on, with their tissues. They want to know what's going on in science. And when they find out sort of after the fact that people are using their tissues they didn't know, especially if money's involved, then you get a lot of mistrust. And there's a lot of discussion about who should profit off science. And I think in a lot of ways that's more about our healthcare system than anything else. It, you know, the rationalization is everyone should, you know, donate tissues and because it helps science and everyone benefits from that and from commercializing because it encourages scientific progress. But in our country, not everyone does benefit. So you have people who donate tissues for research that's funded with tax dollars that's then turned into products that are sold back to people. Many of them can't afford it. So I think we'd see less of the controversy about money and commercialization if we had a different healthcare setup.
You write in several places in this book about the Lax family's spirituality and how it informed their ability to process Henrietta's immortal cells, and also how it contrasted with your own view of religion. Do you think you came out of the process of writing this book at all different from a spiritual level?
Oh, sure. I came out of this process different on probably every level. yeah, you know, I was raised in a family that was not religious at all. I had no experience with much of religion, and Henrietta's family is very different. They believe very much that her soul is alive in these cells and that she was essentially brought back to life as an angel to take care of people. And, you know, as a science, you know, I have a science background, and in science, we often talk about, you know, you hear about science versus religion and the ways that they are opposed to each other. And what I really saw with the Lax family was the ways that the science and religion can work together. You know, if it wasn't for their faith and their belief in her being brought back to life as an angel in these cells, it would have been very difficult and at points traumatizing for them to even really accept that these cells were still living. And, you know, so their faith really helped open them up to learning about the science of the cells and being okay with it. So I learned, you know, I saw a lot of that, but I also, you know, I read the Bible for the first time. I went to church. I was part of, you know, these faith healings and, you know, things that I'd never encountered. And people often ask if it converted me. You know, they say, have you been saved? And the answer is no. I did not change my personal religious beliefs, but it did really teach me a lot about the value of faith and the important role that it plays in people's lives and how positive it can be.
Well, Rebecca Skloot, thanks so much for taking some time with us and helping fill in some more of the story of Henrietta Lacks.
Yeah, thrilled to be there. Thank you.
Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, published by Crown. She lives in Chicago and spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Our interview with her first aired in 2011. With residency requirements for city employees likely to be lifted when the next budget is passed, we look at how that might affect Milwaukee's real estate market. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have your company. The Joint Finance Committee is supposed to conclude its state budget revisions this week ahead of a full legislative vote this month. Along with tax and spending changes, the budget includes a proposal to lift residency requirements for most public workers. Governor Scott Walker had wanted to do away with the restrictions completely. The Budget Committee softened that position, allowing municipalities to require fire, police, and emergency personnel to live within 15 miles of the entities they serve. Well, nothing is final until the budget becomes law, but the committee's plan is likely to take effect next month. And that has realtors wondering how the residency requirement change could affect the local housing market. Mike Ruzicka is president of the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors. He shared his predictions with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley.
Based on what we've seen anecdotally with realtors talking to their clients, we don't really think it's going to have a dramatic impact. One of the things that we really would caution city employees and police and firemen is to not think about, well, the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. And that's one of the things our members have been telling their clients, okay, let's calm down here. Yeah, it's a great right to have. But you don't necessarily want to put a for sale sign in your yard before really kind of walking through and thinking through what the impact is. There could be a lot of people, not only public employees, but just citizens in the whole state, have a very tight home-to-value ratio. For example, if you have a $200,000 house, you might have a $150,000 or $175,000 mortgage on it when you purchased it in, say, 2000. But in the recession, the value went down substantially. And so from 2000 to 2007, maybe it went up 25% or something like that. Most of that gain was lost during the recession. So right now, you're kind of even with where you were in the early 2000s. So a lot of people are saying, well, it doesn't really make sense to sell now. We want to recoup some of that equity we used to have. And so they're going to put off selling. And the other thing, another substantial consideration that 80% of home buyers take into consideration is schools. And a lot of public employees send their kids to really nice, fantastic schools in MPS or private schools, and they don't necessarily want to leave that. And then another component of it is their neighborhood. They've probably been in the neighborhood for several years and know their neighbors and kind of just know the culture of the area. And they're like, well, we really, really like it here. And the other thing is Milwaukee's a very nice city. And being a city employee and living in the city right now, you're very close to all the amenities in the city, the lakefront, you know, the downtown restaurants all over the place. So there are a lot of reasons not to leave, not to put your house up for sale right away. And so we really caution people to think deeply about whether they want to sell their house or not.
I know you ran into some challenges in trying to quantify the potential migration from this. What were those difficulties, and what's the value of trying to quantify how people might move as a result of a residency change?
Just a simple problem of getting lists, getting phone numbers of employees. So it was just a technical thing. But you know, there are other ways to do it. Given where the Joint Finance Committee is in the process, I don't know that it makes sense for us to really try and quantify it right now. We were just curious as to what the impact would be on the marketplace. You know, what's interesting is getting rid of residency at this point in time, the current market conditions really present the ideal time to get rid of residency, because getting rid of residency obviously allows people to move wherever they want. But as I said before, with the loan-to-value ratio, people really need to consider, okay, how much do I have? Do I owe on my loan? What kind of equity do we have? Things like that. In this market, with prices being down so much compared to the peak of the market in 2007, it may not be a great time to sell. So we think that'll have a dampening effect on people's decisions to sell.
The Finance Committee did decide that fire, police, and emergency personnel could live within 15 miles of the entity that they serve. If that becomes law, could we see a specific migration to those rings of land around boundaries? Do you think that'll make a difference?
Yeah, I think that might play into some families' decisions on where to live. But I don't know, you know, if someone was thinking about moving out to Heartland and that's too far away, I don't know that it's going to impact them that much.
You talked about the difficulties of selling and why some people might change. How might a change in residency requirements change supply and demand and affect the cost and ease of home sales, both in Milwaukee and in the suburbs?
If there is any influx, and I don't think there will be, but if there's any influx of properties coming on the market, one of the advantages, to getting rid of residency right now is that we have a deficiency of listings right now. The market is very tight. We're generally under in the market, the four-county area, we're under 6 months of inventory. And usually you want to be between 5, 6, 7. That's kind of a balanced market. But we're actually tending a little bit under 6 months, depending on the specific community you're talking about. So if some properties do come on the market, they'll be absorbed very quickly.
Would a residency requirement change further segregate the region due to white flight or middle class moving out, or would it diversify it possibly with urban minorities moving to the suburbs?
That's a good question. I think hopefully it wouldn't have a negative impact on the area. I don't think it would. But, you know, diversity would certainly be helped by it. I don't think it would hurt at all.
What about the real estate market for businesses? Could we see new shops and restaurants opening in the suburbs if more people moved out that way? Could some possibly close here in Milwaukee?
If there were significant numbers of people moving, I that's possible. But I don't think we'd have that kind of exodus or influx. And one of the things I think that everybody needs to remember is every house that's sold in the city of Milwaukee has to be occupied by someone, because even though someone sells it, and they might move, somebody's moving into that house. So hopefully those people will be gainfully employed. Otherwise, they probably couldn't afford the property. And the properties where public employees live are in really wonderful neighborhoods. So I think they're oftentimes really well kept. So I think those properties would attract very fantastic buyers and families to the neighborhoods. It would also patronize a lot of businesses in the area.
I know in the Legislative Fiscal Bureau report on this to the Joint Finance Committee, they talked about Detroit and Minneapolis saying that when they lifted their residency requirements, a lot of people did leave. But then you look at Detroit declining in general. Mm-hmm. What are those aspects you were talking about, some of them just now, about Milwaukee that would make people want to stay? And why would we not see the significant numbers that some other cities have seen when they've lifted their residency requirements?
Detroit is really a unique animal, and there's so many problems that they've had. But you know, I think Minneapolis is a good example. What other cities have changed? I think Philadelphia and Pittsburgh have recently gotten rid of some components of their residency. And as I said, the properties that are sold are occupied by other families, and those families are just as good as the families that left. So I think that they'll be patronizing local businesses and sending their kids to local schools and things like that, just as the public employees who might leave do. I think it's more the personal decisions. One of the things that a lot of people, especially when you live in the area and you travel throughout the region every day, and you see the warts of the region. But this is a really, really nice area. Everybody, when we have transfers coming into Milwaukee, it's difficult to get them to transfer to Milwaukee in Wisconsin because of our climate, but very seldom do they want to leave. You know, a couple of years later, they're like, boy, our kids really like it here. We like the schools. They can walk or ride their bikes to school or to the pool or wherever. It's just a really, really great area to live in. Another thing that a lot of the opponents of changing residency have mentioned is, for example, Minneapolis, and I think a third of the teachers no longer live in Minneapolis? It's a fairly substantial number. But it really is a product of the recession. A lot of the communities or municipalities and cities that changed the residency requirements did so in the late 90s or maybe early 2000s. And that was right before the boom market started. And we saw people changing where they lived. The level of people moving around the region, not only our region, nationally, was off the charts. And because people bought a house in 2000, they realized it went up in value by 30% a couple of years later. Then they would sell it and buy a bigger one. So there was a lot of movement throughout the first 7 or 8 years of the last decade. Then when the recession hit, everybody stayed put because they couldn't sell their house. And so it's really hard to look at what's going to happen to Milwaukee in the next few years compared to what happened in other cities in the early part of the decade because there was so much movement.
Is there a reason for an advocacy angle too? When you're speaking, are you saying that for realtors, it's a good thing to lift the residency requirement, or are you just looking at the data and saying this is probably what will happen?
No, it wouldn't be better or bad for the market to lift it. We're really mainly concerned with what's the impact on the market going to be. And that's why we were trying to divine, okay, what's the impact? What's our exposure here, both for realtors and their business, but also in the property values in the communities that will be affected? And one of the things I think everybody has to remember is this isn't just Milwaukee. The budget bill lifts residency statewide. So, in fact, Milwaukee County, Madison, Sheboygan, every municipality in the area.
You mentioned earlier schools and involved with that is property tax revenues. If a large number of middle-class families were to leave Milwaukee, what would that mean for property tax revenues and the school system here?
If a lot of people left, as I said before, the new families moving in would pay the property taxes. So I don't think it's going to be that significant. There is a lot of public policy debate about whether people who work in MPS, for example, should live in the district. And those are perfectly fine public policy arguments to have, and I think they are being aired pretty vocally. But as I said, what we're mainly concerned with is, okay, let's dig down to what does this mean to what's going to happen to property values, but also to the number of properties that might come on the market and things like that. And the opponents are painting the worst-case scenario. The proponents are saying it's not going to have any effect. We're somewhere in between. We know that somewhere between zero and every public employee is going to leave Milwaukee, but we're pretty certain that it's going to be on the low end of that scale.
Because you're saying that it's on the low end of the scale, what does that mean for transportation? Would we have more people commuting so that we need roadway expansion or more public transportation, or is it going to be so minor that it's not even going to affect a person's morning commute?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to affect anybody's commute at all. A good example, or just to add some details to it, there are about 250,000 households in the city of Milwaukee. And there are roughly 20,000 public employees, I think just under that. And so if you look at the total number involved, so if all 20,000 public employees had their own house and were part of that 250,000, that would still only be 8% of the households in the market. And if a quarter of them decided to sell, the market would be able to absorb them. There wouldn't be a whole lot additional miles traveled on roads. The impact overall would be fairly minimal.
And the Legislative Fiscal Bureau suggested some alternatives, like allowing a percentage of employees or those with seniority to live outside a given boundary. That's very unlikely any of those changes occurring. But if the legislature were to adopt a change like that, how might that change things in terms of the real estate market?
It would certainly make the number of people that might put their house up for sale smaller, but I don't think it would have a dramatic impact. The number of people involved isn't enough to really change the world of real estate too much.
Mike Ruzicka, thank you for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you very much.
Mike Ruzicka is president of the Greater Milwaukee Association of Realtors. He spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about how lifting the residency requirement for public workers could affect the area real estate market. Ristorante Bartolotta is celebrating 20 years in 2013. We'll talk with a co-owner, Joe Bartolotta, next. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The Bartolotta Restaurants owns and operates many diverse eateries in southeastern Wisconsin, including Lake Park Bistro, Harbor House, Bacchus, North Point, and Rumpus Room. 2013 marks the 20th anniversary of Ristorante Bartolotta, which is the first of these restaurants. Co-owner Joe Bartolotta went to New York right out of high school to learn the restaurant business from the ground up. He returned to Milwaukee and founded the Bartolotta Restaurants with his brother Paul, who's now a chef in Las Vegas. The business has flourished over the last 20 years, employing more than 1,000 people, and it shows no signs of slowing down. But during the past 10 years, Bartolotta was slowing down, having life-threatening medical issues due to complications from diabetes. Thanks to his brother-in-law's organ donation, however, he had a kidney transplant in February and quite literally has a new lease on life. He joined me in the studio recently to talk about both his health and the past 20 years in the restaurant business here in Milwaukee, and he began by explaining the secret to the Bartolotta Restaurant Group's success.
I'd like to think that a lot of it has to do with our culture and who we are and how we treat our people. You know, there's a lot of great restaurants that serve great food. There's a lot of cool-looking places. There's a lot of good service. But I think where a lot of restaurants fail to succeed is that, you know, they don't touch their guests on an emotional level and create a reason for that guest to want to come back. You know, we've all been in restaurants where we've eaten a meal and it's been a really good experience. But for some reason, we've never gone back. So for whatever reason, that restaurant failed to touch you enough or to create that emotional connection enough to want you to come back. And so we've been very successful. And it's primarily through our people and how we treat our people. You know, when you hire a bunch of really sparkly, happy, well-adjusted, team-oriented people and put them together in a business and they're all moving in the same direction at the same time, you become incredibly powerful. And that's really the secret to our success. We really treat our employees very well.
Do you also give them room to experiment and try things that may or may not have worked?
You know, I think we have a very collaborative environment as a company. I love to get a lot of information from a lot of people before we make decisions on how to do something. And I think, you know, the best way to function is to get consensus, because the reality is I'm not in the restaurants every night. My servers are. They know exactly what the customers are saying. They know exactly what's right and wrong. And so I'm a bad business person if I don't listen to what my employees, my line employees, tell me what's going on in our restaurants. So, yeah, I think we're very collaborative. And we also have to function with some form of structure. I think that's another area where other restaurants perhaps struggle a little bit, because it's a very complex business. It's not just serving great food. There's a whole business side of it. And the way we view it is our business has to be sort of a yin and a yang. There has to be the emotional and the creative and the artistic side of our business, but there also has to be the true business side of our business, where you watch your food costs, you watch your labor costs, you watch your expenses. Because at the end of the day, if you just deliver a great experience but don't care about the cost, you'll end up with no money at the end of the day. Conversely, if you end up, you know, too focused on the bottom line, then you cut away and chip away at the guest experience. And I think that's a problem as well. So there's this constant battle that we have. We always do this gut check. Is this the best thing for our guests and is the best thing for our company?
What do you think have been some of your biggest successes in these last 20 years?
Well, this may sound a little hokey, but some of our biggest successes, we had a Christmas party last year. We went to Dave & Buster's and we filled it up. There were about over 1,000 people there. And one of the cool things was I was watching families walk around, a husband and a wife, with two or three little kids following behind them. And again, this is going to sound hokey, but it's truly what I believe is that part of my responsibility is to not only enhance my life and my family's life, but to enhance the people around us and bring everybody's standard of living up a little bit. So we have over 1,000 employees. So I take that very, very seriously. So the fact is, 20 years ago, did I ever think I'd have 1,000 employees? You know, we have we sort of track this very odd statistic, but we have produced through our company, at last count, about 61 weddings and marriages, which have resulted in families and kids and stuff. And a lot of our senior managers, you know, met their significant other while working in the restaurant. And, you know, people fall in love working in restaurants. And
so it's really a big family in a lot of ways.
It so
and
is.
Also a business.
It so is, you know. And there's been a little shift lately in the last couple of years. We've had to run our business a little bit more like a business because the competitive pressures and the pressure of you know, the cost of goods and the raw material costs are going up. So it's creating a lot of pressure on our margin that we have. And so, you know, we have to make these very tough choices sometimes that typically 5 or 6 years ago we wouldn't have had to make.
Such as?
That's a good question. You know, our staffing levels sometimes, you know, we always had what we called a very strong bench. You know, we kept a lot of extra people on because we were in a growth mode and we always wanted to have the opportunity. So when we opened a restaurant, we didn't have to go to the outside. We would always pull people into from our company. We just opened two Joy Girards last year, and that's two very large restaurants. We promoted internally 16 people. So that sort of cleared out our bench, so to speak. It gave a lot of opportunity for people. We promoted 16 people, and then underneath them, we promoted 16 people, you know, to fill those positions that were vacated. So it's a good thing to grow. But, you know, we've had to recognize that there are costs associated with carrying a strong bench. And so we've had to reduce the strength of our bench just a little bit. You know, looking at everything that we look at in our company, we still try to buy the best and still try to afford the best. But now we're being much more aggressive with our vendors and we're looking for better deals out there. We're shopping 3 or 4 vendors against each other to find the best possible price for something. And before, we just would buy it because we wanted it. So little tiny things that all add up to big things.
Well, and one of the big things that's been happening, too, is your own health and the fact that you just recently underwent a kidney transplant. How has that and sort of the concerns for your health over the years affected how you've done business? And is it changing forward now that you're healthy again?
Yeah, I mean, I've had diabetes for 32 years. And as part of the baggage that goes with diabetes is there's going to be complications that come from it. It's a horrible disease, but because it has very significant end stage complications. But pretty much during the run of diabetes, you feel pretty normal, you know. So it's a very slow creep, debilitating disease. And one of the complications that come from diabetes, it affects your small blood vessels, the eyes, you know, the kidneys, the extremities, fingers, toes. And so, you know, I started experiencing some kidney issues about 10 years ago. So, you know, there was plenty of time in the pipeline to plan for this and to prepare for it. And knowing you have a chronic illness, I've never let it slow me down. I've never really let it influence how I run my life. I always have a very optimistic outlook on things. But, you know, when it got to about 2.5 years ago, when the function of the kidney was getting down to 15%, you know, I started to have to think about, okay, I'm going to need either dialysis or I'm going to need a transplant. Dialysis for me was not an option. I could not be strapped up to a machine for 4 hours a day, 3 times a week. It just would have been a horrible life for me. And the prognosis for me on dialysis would not have been a really long one. So we decided to go after the transplant, and I was incredibly fortunate and lucky to have a brother-in-law, my wife's brother, get tested. He put his hand up right away and said, I'll be tested. And you know, he's a 31-year-old guy, super healthy, you know, runs 5 miles a day, just a great outlook on life. We have a lot of similarities personality-wise. And he stepped up and he said, you know, I'll get tested, Joe. And he never wavered. And in 2.5 years, he was always rock solid. So it was a scheduled procedure, and we had the procedure done on February 18th. So I'm about 15 weeks out. And my yeah. life changed overnight. It was like my function was down to 12%. And, you know, less than 15 minutes after the surgery, my function shot up to about 98% kidney function.
Wow.
It is a miracle. It really is. Jamie's function, my brother-in-law's function, went from 100% down to about 46%. The kidneys are incredibly resilient. So within about a three-month period, his remaining kidney will realize that he's under capacity and will start to grow. And it'll grow anywhere from 30 to 40% over the next 2 to 3 months. And he'll be right back up to 98%. So it's an amazing organ. We have such excess capacity with kidneys. You know, kidney donors tend to live longer than most people because in order to even qualify to be a donor, you have to be very healthy. And those people have healthy lifestyles already. So just innately, those people are going to live longer.
And I imagine for you that you already had a special relationship with him because he was your brother-in-law.
No doubt. No doubt.
How has it changed now?
Well, I'll tell you, when we get a little close to each other, we both start to tingle a little bit. I'm kidding. Our kidneys sort of feel the reunion coming as we touch each other. No, you know, there is a very special bond now, even more so than ever. And, you know, he's a very selfless guy who gave of himself. And, you know, he said it was on my bucket list to help somebody. And you're a great guy and you deserve this. And I'm happy to step up and do it. You know, there's some bad information out there right now about kidney transplant and kidney donorship. Years ago, the donors went through a lot of struggles because it was a much more complicated procedure than it is today. Donorship today, Jamie was really back to work in 2.5 weeks. Pretty amazing.
And what about you?
I was in for 6. And then, you know, I recovered about 4 weeks at home. People need to be aware of that it isn't as horrific as they may have been led to believe in the past.
And so it's something that obviously you feel very, very personally strongly connected to. Is it something that you're hoping other people will consider for
well,
all of those
let
people
me give
who
you,
need
Let
it?
Me give you an example. So imagine a 747, a big aircraft filled with people, okay? Now imagine 350 of them crashing at the same time. Horrific idea, horrific thought. That's how many people die every year waiting for a transplant. So if we saw a 350 airplane crash with all passengers on it, we'd do something about it. And yet passively we let a lot of people die on a transplant list. And it can be helped. You know, we can do something about it. I know it's a huge sacrifice. It's a huge gift. It's a huge undertaking for the donors. But, you know, it's the one thing you can do that will save a life. It absolutely saves lives.
And so you're basically looking at quite an extended life now because of this.
There's a very good chance I tacked on another 15 to 20 years of my life. And, you know, it depends on how I manage the rest of my health. I still have diabetes, so I still have to manage that. But, you know, I think I'm going to be great. And my outlook is I'm going to keep opening restaurants, I think.
Well, Joe Bartolotta, it has been great talking with you. I'm so glad to see you in good health and fine fettle, and that the company is as well. And I look forward to many more years of having conversations with you.
Thanks, Bonnie. I appreciate it.
Joe Bartolotta is co-owner of Bartolotta Restaurants, including the Lake Park Bistro, Bacchus, North Point, and the company's first restaurant, Ristorante Bartolotta. There's more information about the business and about kidney donation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.